Just 3 days after Apple announced it had sold a record 10 million new iPhones, the angry social media posts started, photos showing bent phones and complaints of software issues. The shiny rollout of the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus has been dulled, to say the least, and the company is feeling the heat. For more, we turn to NPR's Laura Seidel. And Laura, one of the issues has been with an update to Apple's new operating system, iOS 8. What's going on?
It's a routine update, and it was meant to fix a couple of bugs, such as some apps weren't able to access photos on your phone. But it turns out the fix caused bigger problems, including some people losing voice service. And then a study began circulating by a group called Criticism, which claims that the new iOS has a higher crash rate.
And what's Apple doing about that?
They've pulled the update, and they're advising people to restore the older version. However, this is not always as easy as it sounds.
Well, in addition to this problem with the operating system update, now there are also these complaints about the iPhone 6 bending in people's pockets.
Yes. A video started circulating showing some people bending their iPhone 6 Plus. And that was after complaints from some customers that when they put the iPhone 6 Plus in their pockets, they discovered later that it had a slight bend towards the center. Now, this is Apple's new larger version of the iPhone. It's what some people call a phablet, which is a mix of a phone and a tablet computer. The 6 Plus is thinner than the last phone. It has an aluminum body. But when you design something like that to make it thinner, it can become more fragile. And so anyway, now this hashtag has started on Twitter called Bendgate. Mm-hmm. Some of it had people making jokes like the ultimate hipster choice, my iPhone 6 Plus or my skinny jeans. Mm-hmm. And competitive brands have been having a field day. HTC had a tweet that said, designed to withstand the most demanding environments like your pockets. An Apple spokesperson told me that the company has only had 9 complaints about the problem and that their phones go through a rigorous testing process.
And Laura, not just competitive brands getting in on the act. There's a whole internet meme now of other products shown being bent, a Slim Jim being bent, a Whataburger being bent, all with the hashtag Bendgate. Because after all, what is Twitter for? But things like
right.
this. What does all this mean for Apple in the end?
Well, the stock price took a beating today, and in part because Apple is the company that always sold itself as user-friendly. The late Steve Jobs used to introduce products by saying it just works. He did face a controversy back in 2010 mm-hmm. when Apple released its iPhone 4. That was AntennaGate.
Yes.
And by force of personality, he quelled it. Now, Tim Cook, the current CEO, has to see if he can quiet this, because in many ways, it's a perception problem, and he's not Steve Jobs. So everybody's looking, what is Tim Cook going to do now?
Okay, NPR's Laura Seidel talking about the troubles with Apple's new iPhone models. Laura, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Millions of computers and networks are at risk after a security flaw, which is being called shell shock, was found last week. Now, this is not a virus. It's a bug, a mistake in code. And it turns out it's actually been around for a while. It took 22 years to discover this bug. And the impact could be huge if the security flaw is exploited by hackers. NPR's Elise Hu is here to explain shell shock. So, Elise, what has security companies worried about this thing?
Well, your computer has a type of program called a shell, and that lets you give it commands, for instance, run my web browser, open up this file, that sort of thing. Now, if you use a Mac, that shell is likely a shell called Bash. Bash is where this software bug was discovered. And since this is what runs when you give your computer commands, the worry here is that shell shock could be used to take control of your machine. You can imagine, Linda, if a malicious hacker were to give it the wrong command, such as delete my files or download a nasty virus. So the main concern here is your computer could be shelled into remotely, making users quite vulnerable.
So what is it that has the security companies so worried?
It's the wide scope of the computers and the networks affected, and the potential here for wreaking havoc for any system connected to the internet. Shell shock, as it's been named, affects websites and computers running operating systems like Mac OS, which many of us run, and Linux. It's estimated that more than 80% of the internet serves its websites on that Bash software affected by this bug.
So do the internet companies have to do something?
They have to release patches. And since it does affect so much of the internet, the big companies like Google and Amazon, you don't have to worry about. They have already rolled out software patches for this. The question now is whether smaller sites and programs will patch things up quickly or leave themselves and their users vulnerable.
So is there something that individual users like me, is there something I should do?
Well, Linda, for now, know that the vulnerability does not affect Microsoft Windows users, but Mac users are more at risk here. Apple says not to worry. There's going to be an operating system update or a patch for anyone running the more advanced systems on Macs. But generally, just keep up to date with any software updates and update your computer and mobile devices as Apple releases those. And for the websites you commonly use, the best way you can limit your exposure is just to use different passwords for different services. And also, you could find out who's making the software you're using and what the manufacturer is saying about the shell shock bug so that you can better protect yourself. But Linda, we really won't see the fallout immediately. It's likely to play out over the next few months or even years as the sites that don't patch themselves up and monitor their security closely could leave themselves vulnerable for a long time. And that's when a hacker could take control.
NPR's Elise Hu covers technology and culture for us. You can read more about shell shock on our tech blog, All Tech Considered, at npr.org. Elise, thanks.
You're welcome.
Going to put ride-sharing services to the test in this next story. It seems every month we're hearing about companies like Uber and Lyft facing new legal threats. Right now in L.A. and San Francisco, district attorneys are looking into the quality of the background checks the companies do on their drivers. This comes as a new study in San Francisco shows Uber and Lyft are taking a lot of business away from traditional taxis. NPR's Laura Seidel did a comparison of her own.
I did an experiment with two of my colleagues, Michaeline Duclef and Richard Buster Gonzalez. We stood outside our office in San Francisco, and Michaeline called a taxi, Richard called an Uber, and I called a Lyft.
We are going to take it to the same destination, San Francisco's beautiful Ferry Building. So who's first, fastest, and cheapest? All right, are we ready? Let's go.
I'll tell you who won in a minute, but first here's Amy Keeshan to explain why she stopped using taxis.
I had too many bad experiences where I would call a cab and either be waiting for over an hour or over 2 hours in one case when I was pregnant and standing in front of UCSF Hospital.
But if you talk to traditional taxi drivers, as my colleague Michaeline Duclef did while she raced to the Ferry Building, they'll tell you that riders like Keeshan are taking a risk. Her driver, Abdullah Nabazar, says last New Year's an Uber driver hit and killed a 6-year-old girl.
The Uber said we're not responsible because the driver didn't have the customer in the car. But he was going to pick up somebody.
Taxis in San Francisco are always covered by $1 million of insurance. Uber and Lyft, far less. And Kate Turan of San Francisco's Municipal Transportation Authority says rider services aren't set up to help the disabled. But since traditional taxi drivers are struggling to make ends meet, the number willing to put in the extra time to serve the disabled has dropped.
It's not easy to provide accessible taxi service, and it's something we've been doing for many years, and we still work hard at it. It requires a very robust training program.
Still, there's a feeling that overall service is better for most San Franciscans. Alan Cooper says it's gotten easier to get a traditional cab, and it's often cheaper during peak hours.
I've now found myself in those peak hours when Uber is at 2.5x surge pricing, or this morning, for instance, 10, 15 minutes away is the closest UberX. Hailing a cab is actually much easier.
But at other times, when you're far away from downtown at a non-peak hour, Uber and Lyft have a lot to offer. I took the Lyft.
Okay, so I've arrived, and I'm looking now for Buster or Michaeline.
I waited a couple of minutes.
Did you just get dropped off?
You beat me.
I beat you. How much did it cost you?
it cost Buster $12.09. It cost me $12. Michaeline doesn't arrive until 11 minutes after I do.
Now, how much did yours cost?
$20. $16, and I tipped in.
So, on this trip, Lyft came first, Uber was a close second, and the conventional cab a distant third. But ironically, when it came time to head back to the office, the Lyft driver couldn't find us along the crowded waterfront, so we hopped into an empty taxi. We started chatting with driver Frank Tan, and he shows us his new app, Flywheel. It's like Uber or Lyft for regular taxis.
When after the people use it, they will like it.
Clearly, the competition is forcing traditional cab companies to step up their game, and it's consumers who stand to reap the benefits. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
For years, it did not seem humanly possible to run a mile in 4 minutes. Even when raging bulls were sent behind the runners for extra incentive, they failed. The four-minute mile was finally cracked in 1954, but ordinary folks just cannot run that fast. And that's where a new jetpack comes in. That's the sound of a jetpack developed by researchers at Arizona State University. It's designed to give soldiers a forward thrust, a thrust fast enough to run a four-minute mile. Engineering master's student Jason Carestis researched and designed the 11-pound prototype.
The jetpack is electrically powered, and it uses two high-speed electric ducted fans. And each of these fans pull in about 100 amps at 25 volts. So that's 2,500 watts per motor. The benefit of the electric version is that we have instantaneous thrust. Our motors can go from 0 to 60,000 RPMs in under a second, delivering full thrust almost instantaneously.
The thrusters mean the wearers use less energy, saving their stamina. It also improves agility.
And if you were to envision a scenario where a special forces soldier did have to go in someplace quiet or, you know, even loud, if they can run faster and either get away from people that might be shooting at them, for example, it's much harder to hit a fast-moving target versus a slow-moving target.
And even though it never seemed to be an issue for the $6 million man, running at speeds that we are not designed for has its risks.
Obviously, when you're running at speeds in excess of 15 miles an hour, which is a four-minute mile, if you trip and fall, it's going to hurt. The only other risk that there potentially is that the batteries could heat up because there's quite a bit of current draw, but we haven't experienced any issues with that so far.
So if we can produce this kind of technology now, what is possible in the future?
Today, we have a jetpack that you can run on the ground with, but I would like to hope to see that, you know, there's really no limit to the technology, and as the years pass, we might be, you know, seeing things like this on average everyday people or even jetpacks that make people fly.
Jason Carestis, mastermind behind this four-minute mile jetpack, an engineering master's student at Arizona State University.
He's going the distance.
I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Robert Siegel. On the road for a talk with author Nicholas Carr. Carr's books are the nagging, tech-wary conscience of the digital age. In The Shallows, he warned that surfing the internet is destroying our attention span. And now in his new book, The Glass Cage, Nicholas Carr warns us that computers are starting more and more to make decisions for us and that we risk forgetting how to make those decisions ourselves. He writes a lot about cars. So, we are going to pick him up in this state-of-the-art high-tech driving machine, a 2014 Mercedes-Benz S550 4MATIC sedan. It's a loaner, and Michael Mignelli of Mercedes-Benz USA is our chaperone. Thank you very much for lending us this car this morning.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
And since this car is so far out of my league, we're talking about a $120,000 car here?
Just about that,
You're going to have to explain to me all the amazing things this car can do for me without me having to do them.
Absolutely.
This is Mercedes' top-of-the-line, highest-tech model car you can drive. It parks itself, it controls the windshield wipers. Driving in the dark?
So we have a system called Active High Beam Assist, which will automatically illuminate the road in front of you.
And if a car is approaching in the opposite direction?
It will automatically lower them and continuously lower them to the amount where it will never dazzle the driver.
Talk about dazzling the driver. This car has something called Distronic Plus.
There's the stereo camera, and then there's also short, medium, and long-range radars that are continuously monitoring the traffic situation both in front and behind the vehicle.
At one point, as I was driving in rush hour traffic to Nicholas Carr's hotel in Washington, D.C., I tried this Distronic Plus system out. The system kept me in my lane. Had I strayed, it would have taken over the steering. And it maintained my distance from the taxi that had just cut in front.
The car ahead of me is moving, so...
So you don't have to use your...
The car is following it. Yeah. I'm not accelerating right now.
That's correct. And you're not braking.
I'm not braking. And now the car ahead of me is slowing down, so this car is slowing down.
Correct.
No hands, no feet. The Mercedes was driving itself.
Nick Carr, welcome.
Thank you.
I decided to pick you up in the All Things Considered mobile studio.
It's very impressive.
I have arrived driving Nick Carr's nightmare. We set out for a glimpse of what's to come in nearby Arlington, Virginia. And as I drove, we talked about automation and what it has done for us and to us.
In 700 feet, turn right onto New Hampshire Avenue Northwest.
For Nick Carr, automatic navigation demonstrates how technology gives to human beings while also taking away.
At least you used to have to figure out where you were. And even with a paper map, you'd have to locate yourself somewhere and figure out what the landmarks around you are and kind of get a sense of place. And that's no longer necessary when you have, you know, the voice come on and say, in 500 yards, turn left, 200 yards, turn right. I do think there's something lost there.
And it's not just behind the wheel of a vehicle that can drive itself where Nicholas Carr sees a worrying loss of autonomy.
Well, you see it in a lot of professions. So if you go in these days to have your annual physical, usually now the doctor is spending a good deal of time looking into a computer to enter information that they used to dictate notes about the visit or write down themselves, to kind of go through processes, templates that give them hints on diagnosis and stuff. Can be good, can be not so good, but changes the doctor-patient relationship in very interesting ways. Pilots, the name of the book, The Glass Cage, refers to what pilots call the glass cockpit, that more and more they're flying by looking at banks of computer monitors.
But you acknowledge that overall the number of air crashes we've had over the past couple of decades since we've automated is way, way down.
It is. I mean, the whole history of aviation is a history of flight becoming much, much safer. Mm-hmm. And some of that is definitely due to autopilots and automation systems. But I think what we're seeing, and, you know, the Federal Aviation Administration is concerned about this and has sent out alerts, is that pilots just aren't getting enough practice in manual flying. Almost the entire flight now is done on autopilot. And so on those rare, thankfully rare occasions when something unexpected and bad happens, pilots often make mistakes because their skills have gotten rusty. So I think the lesson isn't that automation is bad, but we have to be very wise in knowing how to automate and when to say no. Let's not take more control away from the human being.
I've been talking with Nicholas Carr, whose new book, The Glass Cage, is a warning against the potential dangers of some kinds of automation. And so far, we've been in the present, at least a very expensive version of the present, driving this amazing Mercedes-Benz. But now we're at the Virginia Tech Transportation Institute at their research center in Arlington, Virginia. And now we're going to get a glimpse of the future with Ray Resendez. Tell us about the Cadillac we're about to take a ride in.
So we have a Cadillac SRX. We have added a technology called dedicated short-range communications. Coupled with GPS, the vehicle puts out a basic safety message, which basically put is saying, here I am, here's the location of a vehicle. Other cars equipped with the same technology can hear that, and just like an air traffic control system, can start figuring out who's in my path, am I in an imminent crash danger?
Virginia Tech and the Virginia Department of Transportation have also placed short-range radio transmitters on selected roads and highways. Ray Resende's Cadillac receives their transmissions and displays them on the dashboard navigation screen. We see a recommended speed on an exit ramp. As we pass a school, we get a warning that school children are nearby. When a second Virginia Tech car, outfitted like the Cadillac, passes us, we get an alert. Nicholas Carr says he worries about people being bombarded with such automatic alerts in our future cars and everywhere else.
This is something called alert fatigue. Doctors now, when they use computers, they'll often be alerted to possible drug interaction problems. These alerts come up so often now that the doctors start just dismissing them automatically because a lot of them are completely useless, it turns out. There is a big problem that the systems become so sensitive and give you so many alerts that you actually become less alert yourself because you're just dismissing the alerts.
And here's another question that Nicholas Carr writes about. If the car of the future will make decisions for us, how will it decide what to do when a collision is unavoidable and a computer is in charge of the steering?
You have to start programming difficult moral, ethical decisions into the car. You know, if you are going to crash into something, what do you crash into? You know, do you go off the road and crash into a telephone pole rather than hitting a pedestrian or, you know, things that we do, and we might not do them that well all the time, mm-hmm. but...
Very interesting issue, because if you look at crashes, the best crash to get into is to rear-end somebody else, because cars are well-designed to deal with that. A lot of times people will steer to avoid a rear-end collision, and then you can run into head-on collision, which is the worst crash, or you can hit a pedestrian. Having to codify these issues into the algorithm on a vehicle is a very serious issue.
That's Ray Resendez of Virginia Tech. Nicholas Carr's complaint against intrusive automation isn't just about how well or how poorly computers might make moral decisions for us. It's about the very erosion of human autonomy.
Once we start taking our moral thinking and moral decision-making away from us and putting it into the hands, not of a machine really, but of the programmers of that machine, then I think we're starting to give up something essential to what it means to be a human being.
It's Nicholas Carr, author of The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. By the way, he told me that he drives an Audi A4 with no navigation system.
We're going to hear now about two of the most controversial words in education these days, screen time. One fear about screen time is that it's hurting kids' social skills. On Morning Edition today, we heard about a recent experiment. Researchers found that kids who spent time away from electronic devices got better at reading emotions on people's faces. But for some educators, screen time isn't all bad. Corey Turner of the NPR Ed team has the story of one Los Angeles school that's embracing technology in an effort to protect kids from it.
Yay! Can you say good morning, Ms. Vogelstrom?
Good morning, Ms. Vogelstrom.
The hallways are humming with kids at Westside Neighborhood School. It's morning. A gaggle of first graders has wrapped up breakfast and heads to class. WNS is an independent school, pre-K through 8th, tucked into the shadow of a Home Depot in L.A.'s booming Playa Vista neighborhood. It's close enough to the ocean that the air is more salt than smog.
So our third grade is on this side, and here is the lab right here.
I get the grand two-story tour from Judith Joy. She's executive assistant to the head of school, and she walks me to the technology lab.
So you can see we have a room full of computers, and then on the side we have our nice little robots that the kids get to play with and tinker around with. And you should see the stuff they create. It is really awesome.
We'll come back to the lab in a minute, but first, the man behind Westside's pretty radical technology policy, head of school Brad Zacuto. When it comes to talking about screen time and kids' access to handheld devices, he likes to use an old-fashioned analogy.
It's like putting a child behind a wheel of a car. There's a lot of power there.
Zacuto says, think about how dangerous it was back when cars first hit the road. No traffic lights or street signs. Well, that's where we are now, he says, with kids and all this technology at their fingertips.
It's here to stay. But at some point, you have to teach kids how to use, drive a car responsibly.
How does he do that? First, no smartphones till sixth grade. Even then, kids can bring them to school, but they have to check them at the front desk. Second, by engaging and educating parents. WNS makes them sign a commitment to limit screen time at home and to keep kids off of social media, again, till sixth grade. Also, at school, no technology at all until second grade.
We choose to have our youngest children engaged in digging in dirt and building things and using their hands.
Not just hands, but eyeballs and brains, too, interacting with other kids face to face, because they need lots of early practice relating, reading emotion, and responding to it. Screen time just gets in the way. In second grade, Zacuto says, kids start using classroom laptops. They get some basic lessons in typing and word processing, and their first taste of internet research, which makes this a good time to go back to that technology lab.
Hi, how's it going? Don Fitzroy, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Don.
Don Fitzroy is EdTech coordinator at Westside Neighborhood School. By fourth grade, just about every student has sat through a class like this.
So we're going to be talking about digital citizenship today. And I wanted to begin by giving you guys an opportunity to watch a short video about something called a digital footprint.
The idea is to get kids to think hard about the dangers of social media before they have Twitter handles or Facebook pages. After the video, Fitzroy sits in a half circle with a handful of students and talks through a cautionary tale.
They say something online, and then suddenly they say, I'm going to delete this. I know I changed my mind. I didn't mean to say that. And it's out there.
13-year-old Tom Zimmerman gets it.
One example, this one kid who was like, in this room, and he had like this fake lightsaber, and he was acting really crazy, and it looked really stupid. And it was funny, but I'm sure that kid won't want it in the future. But so many people have taken that video and put it on their channels that there's no way of getting rid of it.
That video of one kid in a heated lightsaber battle with himself is pretty amazing. He's swinging a golf ball retriever, and he's just so intense about it, high stepping, swatting the floor, losing his balance. It's been watched millions of times. But the so-called Star Wars kid, now in his 20s, says he was bullied because of it and had to leave school, which gives principals like Brad Zacuto not one, but two big reasons to worry about screen time. Because of what's not happening, important face-to-face time, and because of what is happening, kids putting themselves out there in embarrassing and potentially dangerous ways, which raises the question, what is good screen time?
It's all about how things are used and how much they're used and what they're used for.
Patricia Greenfield co-authored that study we mentioned in the intro. She's a professor of psychology at UCLA and has been writing about screen time for 30 years. She says, for example, asking kids to write an essay using the computer can be a good thing. It can help with spelling and grammar, and they can use the internet for research. Here's the key.
You're not substituting screen time for interaction time. You're substituting alone time with the screen for alone time with your paper and pen.
Greenfield describes a kind of cost-benefit analysis. Is this screen time coming at the expense of face-to-face time? And what unique value does the technology add? At Westside Neighborhood School, when kids use tech, often they're still working collaboratively and doing things they couldn't do without it. Again, head of school, Brad Zacuto.
We have a design class where they imagine a product, they design it, and we have a 3D printer where they then create it. I mean, there's amazing things going on that's preparing them for the world they're going into.
Another simpler example, math homework. Kids in the same class but at different skill levels can do work that matches their ability. And starting in sixth grade, Zacuto students can do it all on school-issued tablets. Some teachers even put short lectures online for students to watch at home.
It sort of flips the content. I'd rather be spending my time in school with the teacher, with the kids, doing interactive collaborative, using what we've learned.
Which, oddly enough, means using screens to increase the time kids at WNS spend working face-to-face. It's a delicate dance, preparing kids for both the digital age and the social world. But it's important not to sacrifice one for the other, says Yelda Uhls, who co-authored that screen time study with Patricia Greenfield. When kids hit middle school, she says, the balance of power in their lives tilts away from their parents toward friends.
One of the reasons it's so miserable is because we're trying to learn our place in the social world outside of our safe little haven at home.
The more practice kids get reading emotion in voices and posture, the better they'll be able to navigate the turmoil of early adolescence. And that kind of learning just won't fit in the palm of your hand. Corey Turner, NPR News, Washington.